oak trees, calico cats, water, had a perfect form, usually capitalized when referring to specific entities. Penrose has no objection to extending his theory beyond mathematics. Such existence could also refer to things other than mathematics, such as to morality or aesthetics. Plato himself would have insisted that there are two other fundamental absolute ideals, namely that of the beautiful and that of the good. I am not at all averse to admitting the existence of such ideals. This candid admission works against him with scientists who would apply external existence only to numbers. But if you stand back, calling mathematics orderly and balanced isn't starkly different from calling it beautiful and harmonious. Beauty transcends a rough and tumble world. Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek has taken the next step and offered a physicist's defense of beauty as a human ideal rooted in reality out there. His brilliant 2015 book, A Beautiful Question, states its aim in a bold subtitle, Finding Nature's Deep Design. The question at hand is the same one that Plato asked more than 2,000 years ago. Does the world embody beautiful ideas? For Plato, the word idea was interchangeable with form, and anyone who considers themselves an idealist can trace their aspirations back to ancient Greece. On the mathematical side, Wilczek points to Pythagoras, who shared the same dream that nature would turn out to conform to a perfect geometry. This belief died hard, but it did die. So why would two acclaimed physicists resurrect it? In Wilczek's version, quantum physics has already exposed a deep reality that he terms the core. There is enough hard evidence to suggest that all the laws of nature and principles of physics are unified at the core. The classical ideal of planets traveling in perfect circles hasn't survived, Wilczek says. But in the quantum era, the most daring hopes of Pythagoras and Plato to find conceptual purity, order, and harmony at the heart of creation have been far exceeded by creation. You may think that this is the harmony of an advanced mathematician, and too abstract to translate into beauty in the material world, that we would be left with the same yawning gap between quantum reality and everyday reality. It was this gap that motivated physicists to look for an underlying design in the first place. Wilczek is capable of waxing eloquent in terms that anyone can appreciate. There really is a music of the spheres embodied in atoms and the modern void, not unrelated to music in the ordinary sense. Harmonia Mundi, the music of the spheres, was a cherished goal for many classical astronomers, including Johannes Kepler. When he made his famous discovery of planetary motion, Kepler considered it a secondary achievement on the way to proving the existence of Harmonia Mundi, a discovery that would mean the angels really do sing. Note the push and pull motion as Penrose and Wilczek fit the human world into their theories. Penrose is openly distrustful of how the individual mind operates, restating the old, conventional mistrust of subjectivity. That's why he wants to give mathematical structures a reality of their own. For our individual minds are notoriously imprecise, unreliable, and inconsistent in their judgments. The precision, reliability, and consistency that are required by scientific theories demand something beyond any one of our individual, untrustworthy minds. Wilczek is more humanistic. He reveres beauty and wants to rescue the ancient ideal of man as the measure of all things. One of the key illustrations in his book is the famous drawing by Leonardo of a naked man with his arms and legs pictured in two positions. In the first position, the limbs fit inside a perfect circle. In the second, they fit inside a square. There's an ancient mathematical riddle referred to here, known as squaring the circle. Centuries ago, geometry could use simple instruments like calipers and rulers to match up squares, triangles, and other straight-lined forms. They also hoped to do the same with the circle. The challenge was to take a circle of a known area and construct a square with the same area in a finite number of steps. The problem was never solved, but Leonardo's drawing is like a clue pointing in the direction of the human body. Wilczek is very sympathetic to this kind of thinking. His drawing suggests that there are fundamental connections between geometry and ideal human proportions. This idea goes back to an even more ancient conviction that the universe is mirrored in the human body, and vice versa. Sadly, perhaps, we humans and our bodies don't figure prominently in the world picture that emerges from scientific investigation. Because they consider themselves realists, the vast majority of practicing scientists will regard the word ideal with the same distrust that they do design. Wilczek and Penrose find themselves facing a steep uphill climb. You'll remember the anthropic principle, which attempts to restore human beings to a privileged place in the universe. Penrose's eternal mathematics doesn't square with that, and Wilczek details a number of objections, as we have too, that make anthropic thinking iffy. But iffy or not, many roads diverge as soon as anyone tries to connect humans and the cosmos by design. Of course, we're attached to the universe as our home. But saying that this connection is part of the cosmic blueprint hasn't led to any sort of settled agreement. Will it ever? Earth's biosphere is an island of negative entropy that has no scientific reason to exist except that it does exist. The same may be true of cosmic design. Physics may never write the magic equation that brings form out of chaos. But nature is filled with pattern, structure, and form anyway. In broad terms, modern physics is content to believe that the core, or deep reality, is subject to orderly unified principles. With a bit of hedging, most scientists also accept that mathematics transcends life on Earth and the fallible human mind. Numbers are a truth waiting to be found, but their existence won't change whether anyone finds them or not. Clearly, these two points of agreement aren't enough to build the human universe on, not by themselves. The remaining mysteries are about filling in the gap. It won't do to act as if human beings are incidental specks in a cold, empty void, where randomness rules absolutely. No matter how many physicists persist in this viewpoint, there's no denying that humans are woven into the very fabric of creation. Just how far this goes will determine if we are co-creators of a cosmos that begins with the human mind, not the Big Bang. There may be no other alternative that fits the facts, and fitting the facts is what science is all about. Is the quantum world linked to everyday life? History has produced more than its fair share of monsters, and when we think about them, we wonder how they could live with themselves. Not just millions, but tens of millions of people perished as a result of the actions of Hitler, Stalin, and Chairman Mao. It's chilling to see the home movies of Hitler playing with little children, taking time off from being a monster to assume the part of a smiling uncle. Why didn't guilt set in? One explanation traces back to an aspect of human psychology that's fairly common, called splitting, also known as black and white thinking. Splitting occurs when a person can't join the positive and negative sides of their personality. We all compartmentalize our psychology, keeping under wraps what we don't want other people to see. But splitting takes it to the extreme, allowing someone to be a monster and a nice person without the two sides ever meeting. When neighbors of serial killers invariably describe the murderer as normal and nice, this may be evidence of splitting. The price of living with monstrous deeds is to separate existence into two compartments that do not communicate. Splitting has a scientific side too, if we use the term metaphorically. As we've touched upon several times, Einstein's relativistic model is extremely accurate at describing how gravity works and the behavior of large objects in space-time, while quantum theory is equally precise in its description of how the other three fundamental forces work and the behavior of very small objects. The importance of this schism seems abstract. If you know how everything, large and small, behaves, isn't that the same as complete knowledge? The problem comes down to a simple fact that affects all of us. There is only one reality, not two. A person who has split off his monstrous side is still responsible for what the split-off part did. In court, the good side isn't let off while the bad side goes to jail. Physics has lived with its split for over a century, attempting to unify reality, but with limited success. This is a case in which ordinary people have a stake, because the way we live our lives depends on what we accept as real. It was inconceivable in the Middle Ages to live one's life while shutting out God. In an age of faith, nothing was more real than God, and excluding its reality, as it seemed, would be tantamount to delusion, a crime against nature, and surely lead to eternal damnation. Today we live our lives blithely without paying any attention to the quantum world, and no one is being accused of delusion or heresy. It seems innocuous to split off this most fundamental level of reality. But in this audiobook, we contend that reality is basically human, and that claim doesn't hold water if the quantum world is excluded. It's precisely quantum behavior that matters the most. Here's a prime example. In the game of Scrabble, you look at your letter tiles, and you have A, O, R, S, S, U, U, which looks pretty hopeless. Then you notice that another player has put the word all on the board. With a triumphant cry and a slightly pitying smile, you can now use all of your tiles to make Allosaurus and earn a whopping bonus. At first glance, this little victory has nothing to do with the split between relativity and quantum mechanics. But in fact, you have been inhabiting both worlds the whole time you played Scrabble. Shuffling letters around to make words is a large object activity. You have to assemble the right pieces to make sense of scrambled letters. Yet your brain doesn't go through this procedure when you are choosing which word to speak. Mentally, you pluck the word you want to say, and the brain delivers it. There is no searching among alphabet letters. For every word in your vocabulary, the spelling, meaning, and sound are fused into one concept, not assembled from scattered parts. In general, your brain forms connections between billions of neurons, often in widely separated regions of the brain. What's mysterious is how these connections can operate, instantaneously and without any visible communication. The processing speed of neurons can be measured, but that's a different issue from how scattered clumps of neurons know to join an activity where teamwork is demanded, as opposed to sending a specific signal down a series of neurons connected like a telephone line. The various patterns needed to coordinate movement, speech, and decision-making pop into place automatically. Thus, when you see your mother's face, it comes to mind as a face you recognize, not random noses, eyes, and ears that must be examined individually. This looks like something akin to quantum behavior, if nothing else, because cause and effect don't proceed one step at a time. If your mind had to proceed in linear fashion, step by step, recognizing your mother's face would be like the following. Caller 1. Hi, cerebral cortex, this is the visual cortex. You left a message? Caller 2. Yeah, I want to see my mother's face. Can you help? Caller 1. Certainly, hold on. Okay, I've retrieved some likely eyes. Let's start with those, because most people remember their mother's eyes pretty vividly. We'll get to the other parts once you pick the right eyes. Caller 2. Okay. Look, I'm on a schedule. How long is this going to take? The dialogue sounds comical when slowed down, but even if all the separate parts of your mother's face were being assembled at lightning speed, it wouldn't be instantaneous and holistic. Yet the brain produces the three-dimensional world instantaneously and holistically, exactly the way the quantum world produces large objects like mountains, trees, and everyone's mother. Leaving the quantum world out of your lifestyle is the same as leaving out your brain. No one does this in reality, of course, because the brain is an absolute essential every minute of our lives. What we do exclude is the connection to the quantum world. This has cosmic implications. For decades, a quip has circulated that's attributed to Sir Arthur Eddington. Not only is the universe stranger than we imagine, it is stranger than we can imagine. It turns out that the attribution was false. The actual speaker remains unknown, and the insight may be wrong too. The universe may precisely fit what we can imagine. Instead of a universe where particles, atoms, and molecules are mind-like, it seems more likely to us that the universal mind has a way of displaying and acting matter-like. The issue can't be settled until a new mystery is confronted. Is the quantum world linked to everyday life? Grasping the mystery. There is no doubt that quanta are part of the everyday world. When plants convert sunlight into chemical energy, a quantum, the photon, is being processed. Quantum activity is also thought to enable birds to navigate on long migrations by following the Earth's magnetic field. Processing electromagnetism in the bird's nervous system would be a quantum effect. Even so, the division between quantum behavior and the ordinary things we experience is crucial in physics. A specific name, the Heisenberg cut, was given to the dividing line that separates quantum events from our perception. Heisenberg himself didn't propose the name. It was bestowed later in his honor. But his thinking repeatedly indicated that there was a theoretical line dividing how quantum systems behaved in their